All right, we all are right. Live.
Woo! We're back. It's been a while.
It has been a very long time, but I'm back here with my partner in crime, Arnie. I've done a few of these on my own, and it's been lonely. I've been a very lonely chap, and glad to have Arnie back in the chair.
I'm glad to come back to give you my presence and my voice like open arms. Give you a warm podcast hug right now, Sean. And you too, Scott. We should probably introduce our guest too for everyone.
I'm feeling it.
Let's not let Scott feel left out. Scott, welcome to the show. Glad to have you here.
Yay.
No, thank you. Thanks for having me. Enjoying and looking forward to it.
Very good. Very good. Well, Arnie knows you a lot better than I, but I've been stalking you for a little while, so you know that's slightly creepy. But tell us a bit about yourself.
Yeah, look, I actually live on the Central Coast in New South Wales, and you know I quite fortunate that I have what many aspire to have, which is that sort of seaside life. It's a great lifestyle. I've got a young family, and we really enjoy the amazing nature and surrounds that we have. And you know, in my spare time, I love getting out, and I've got a boat. I love to go fishing. I love spending time with my kids at in the beach and some of the surrounding precincts and parks. I suppose that's probably a bit about me on a personal front.
Yeah, lovely. Nice. So you're living the dream.
Well, I like to think so.
Yeah, that's great.
Not the complete dream.
It's so good.
That's good. And Arnie, what have you been up to in the time that we've been apart on this pod?
Oh, geez, Sean, it's been a long time. I mean, my little one just turned 6 months, actually.
Hang on. Your little one, we haven't even covered
that. We've covered that at some point. Was he just expecting?
Yes.
Oh, really? Has it been that long?
It's been that long.
Well, okay, so for the audience, hi everyone. I have a son. I'm a dad now, so I'm allowed to officially say dad jokes. So hopefully I pull out some good ones today, because I've hit that. Scott's nodding because I think he's got a few good dad jokes up his sleeve. He knows all about it. Okay, great. So I have a son, everyone. His name is Ariston. And what can I tell you? He's healthy. He's lively. Definitely really lively. Loves to eat. Has a few sort of eczema kind of issues, but you know what? He's fit and healthy. And I keep reminding my wife that, you know, don't worry about the things he doesn't have. Think about the things that he does have, which is great. So he just turned 6 months actually yesterday. So it's been six months. Has it been 6 months? It can't been that long.
It has. No, it has. It definitely has.
Oh my goodness.
I think there's been a couple of eps I've done where I've said, I've referred to, you know, the impending fatherhood, but not since. So congratulations.
Well, there you go. It's probably a reflection of how quickly the time has gone. With little Aris around, but he's been keeping me busy. So I love it. Like, honestly, you know, we talk about living the dream. I feel like I'm living the dream right now. Honestly, it's phenomenal. I highly recommend it.
Yeah, that's good. All right, so Scott, do you have any dad jokes you're willing to share? You got a zinger for us?
Come on. Yes.
Oh, well, I think you go to the old stock standard. You know, why do fathers take an extra pair of socks when they go golf? In case they get a hole in one.
Yes. Woo. Hold on, let me write that down.
We need a sound effect for that. We need some.
Is it?
It's actually quite sad, isn't it?
I'll let one in. Yeah. All right, let's get into it, because I'm really curious to hear about your story, Scott. So
yes.
Talk to us about your leadership journey. Go back as far as you like, and we're in your hands.
Yeah, thanks, Sean. I think my journey in contact centres is probably, now expands beyond 20 years. But if I reflect on my journey and where I'm at today and some of, the key things that have shaped and informed my leadership style and how I think about contact centres, it probably predates my first role going into the contact centre. And I go all the way back to my first job, which is a lot like many young teenage kids, and that's going to McDonald's. And I didn't know at the time that there would be so many sort of foundational skills or knowledge or insights that I would get from that experience that would sort of really carry all the way through my career and into the contact center. And, you know, there's lots of similarities and synergies between what makes a great successful McDonald's store to what makes a great successful contact center. And, you know, it's things like, you know, the volume of recruitment that a McDonald's store would do, you know, the training and onboarding programs they have in place, and things like, you know, the introduction to processes and procedures and how that drove quality control and standardization, and, you know, the work they did around, you know, teamwork and camaraderie, you know, as big parts of their culture, even things like, you know, reward and recognition. You know, I know in contact center world, you know, there's been a bit of a buzz over the last five, probably a little bit longer years around gamification, you know, introducing sort of, you know, badges and you know, the concept of stars or personalization to sort of recognize and motivate people. McDonald's were doing that 40 plus years ago in a physical form. You know, you master a particular section and they give you a little pin that you'd put on your uniform and wear with pride. So I think there was a whole lot of things that prepared me really well for going into the contact center. But my journey was never, I never knew I wanted to be in a contact center. I think there was a bit of a life moment where I grew up in a small regional country town, and, you know, there wasn't a lot of opportunity. I'd graduated from high school and I was sort of in a bit of a limbo, and I made the decision to, you know, pack up and move to the city and try my luck. And it was there that, you know, I applied for a role in a contact center, and I was really fortunate that they took a chance on me as a young kid going into a very large organization in a corporate setting. And, you know, I'm not ashamed to announce who it was, because I know in the last couple of weeks have copped a lot of bad press. But my experience with Optus was an incredible one. And I actually think it probably had the biggest impact on my career in terms of what I learned and what I was afforded in terms of opportunity and development. And so, you know, when I got to Optus, young kid, started in an entry-level role, and I think, you know, in the 12 years I was there, I sort of describe it as growing up, my professional growth. I grew up in the contact center, and I had the opportunity to work in nearly every role that sat within the contact center. So I had, by the time I got to you know, the 12-year mark, I'd not only performed, you know, from, you know, initial call taking to coach, team manager, ops manager, contact center manager, I'd had the opportunity to lead large, diverse teams across multiple channels in both service and sales. And it was really at the end of my time with Optus that I made the choice to want to go into sales, because I'd spent a large part in service, and I really wanted, I'd always had this burning ambition to get into sales, but perhaps, I think maybe a little bit of self-doubt held me back. But I think, you know, having such a great culture and such a great supportive framework in place that, you know, really defined Optus, it made a little bit easier. And I think when I went into that sales contact center, that was probably one of my first big learnings, other than everything I learned on my journey, as you would imagine, because Optus was what I'd describe as probably a very typical sort of conventional contact center, as people would know. Obviously, the key difference being their unique culture. At the time, they were very much, you know, saw themselves as the challenger brand. And so it really defined, you know, the behaviours of the organisation. We were brave, we were bold, and we really wanted to take it to Telstra. And so that was an exciting time. But when I moved into the sales environment, that's where I got exposure to a completely different culture and set of operating routines and rhythms that was sitting within the same organization. And I thought that was really interesting how, you know, in the one umbrella with such a strong culture and such a strong purpose and framework, how you could have these two different areas of the contact center with very unique traits. And it sort of opened my eyes into, you know, the different people that a sales contact center attracts, the different characters, personalities, but also a lot of the rhythms and routines that go in and around making for a successful sales organization. So I did that, and then, you know, sort of after 12 years, I wanted to see what it would be like on the other side of the sales and service delivery arm and go into face-to-face. So I made the decision to go into retail. And it was at that point I made the big switch from, you know, the big O to the big T. At that point in time, you know, Telstra were doing a major revamp of their company-owned retail stores, and they were bringing in new store leaders and giving them probably unprecedented empowerment to really run those stores like it was their own business. And so, you know, they gave end-to-end accountability to the P&L, to the hiring, to the firing, to the local area marketing. And so it was an exciting time to come in, but obviously having had no experience in retail, it was a steep learning journey. You know, I learned a lot in my time in retail. You know, when I first go into any new team or any new role, I like to spend, you know, a fair amount of time really just making observations and immersing myself to understand the culture, the people, the customers, you know, the processes, the systems, and really ask those curious questions around why do we do what we do, to understand, you know, is it actually fit for purpose? Is there opportunity before, you know, I come in and, you know, look to, you know, stamp my, you know, my mark on it? Because I think what I have learned over my time is no two contact centers are the same. And you can't just apply a cookie cutter approach and think what worked well in one is going to work well in another. You really need to overlay and understand the culture, the purpose of that organization, and the people that sit within it, and the customers. And so when I went into that Telstra store, I spent the best part of, you know, a month really just observing. And it was probably at that point in time where another sort of learning for me really started to crystallize. You know, it had been around for a while, this, you know, the concept of omni-channel experience or unified experience through your channels. But I never really understood how that would play out in practice and what impact that would have. And then when I went into the store, I got firsthand real life experience of why that's so important. You know, if I think back to my time at Optus, you know, often, you know, you probably find a CSR would be talking to a customer, it might get a little bit challenging or a bit all too hard, and they take the easy out of referring the person into the store and saying, hey, do you want to go and speak to someone? They can sit down and, you know, they'll take you through it, not knowing or appreciating that often people in a retail store don't have the same level of training, skills, access to systems, even empowerment to make decisions or to resolve inquiries. So inadvertently, they're sending a frustrated, unresolved customer really into, you know, into a poor, unsuspecting retail person that's about to cop it and probably doesn't have the skills or the resources to be able to resolve that inquiry. So it really helped me understand, you know, the importance of not having these silos between your channels and how you've got to work hard around that sort of seamless transition and remove the friction. But you know, so that was probably a really interesting insight. The other one was a bit like my experience of some of the similarities I saw from a McDonald's store into a call center. I started to see the same present into a retail setting of things that make for a very successful contact center, how they could be implied in a retail setting. And that really played out for me in when I started just, you know, observing my team and how they go about their day, it was very unstructured. You know, you had six or seven people sitting on a retail floor, and you had customers just wandering in no particular order, and you had no real idea of what that customer's inquiry was about. And it was just the next person available would walk up, greet the customer, and then look to solve it. And you know, there was no order. It was really inefficient. We weren't matching skills to customer inquiry types or customer outcomes. And for anyone that's worked in retail, you understand just how costly retail is. You know, you sort of, your measures are, you know, revenue per square meter of footprint that you've got in that retail store. So if you're not getting the balance right of delivering a great customer experience that's going to drive, you know, sales growth and revenue opportunity, you know, you're going to find yourself very quickly in an unprofitable situation, and it's unsustainable. So it was there where I started to go, well, what if I actually started to just structure the retail setting and my store and team design to actually match the different inquiry types and start to understand the skills and capabilities of my existing team and apply it and match it to the customer. And that's where I introduced roles where people had, you know, key accountabilities. And, you know, we had a dedicated sales team. We had a dedicated service team. We had a dedicated technical team. And we had a management group that were a little bit rudderless, now very clear on what their role was. It was real-time coaching, greeting and supporting and farewelling customers, and being there as the escalation point when things go wrong so they can pull that customer aside and let the staff get on with it. And I think that was a huge change and a key driver of the success that we saw as a team in our time there. Not only did it drive up customer experience, you know, by the time I left, we were one of the most profitable stores in the state. And so I really enjoyed my time in retail. I stayed just under 2 years, but then I had a bit of a itching to get back into the contact center. But I knew that my time in telco had probably run its distance, and it was time for something different. And so I wanted to challenge myself into going into another industry, and I moved into online education. So I started, so it was a big leap away from telco, and it was a really interesting journey that challenged and stretched me in a number of different ways. What we were essentially doing was we were an online broker on behalf of educational providers, but we weren't just a sort of marketing arm. We actually did a full consult and enrollment on behalf of the partner for, you know, prospective students. And so it was a very different type of sale, very different in terms of the significance for the customer, the emotional connection and buy-in. It wasn't just about you had to look at, you know, were you matching the right product to the customer? You really had to understand, you know, are they ready and committed and have the capacity to dedicate 4 years of their life to do a degree? You know, and are we setting them up for success in making sure that they graduate and that then, you know, leads to their career outcome? So it was a high stakes type of sale. But what was really interesting is when I got into this environment, It was very much like a startup feel in this organization, very sort of Google-esque. You know, you walk in, they've got a great big breakout room, ping pong table, you know, a barista coffee machine. They provide breakfast for everyone, a beer and wine fridge. Everyone's walking around in activewear. You know, you've got walking across the floor. I've got people greeting me with a wet towel over their shoulder because they've just come out of a shower. And they're heading to start the day. It was just completely foreign to everything I had ever seen or known of a contact center. And then as I started to do those observations and get underneath how they operated, there was probably no resemblance of a traditional contact center. You know, there was no structure. There was no metrics, you know, there was no reporting on agent productivity or how many calls they made or how long they took. There were no rosters. There was no adherence, compliance. None of those traditional metrics, you know, existed. The technology was pretty basic and primitive. You know, most of what we were doing was outbound, dialing customers, but we were doing it old school, manually entering the number, hitting call, you know, no dialers. And so what became really interesting is, over the course of, you know, 4 weeks and getting to know the people and see how it worked, even though it defied everything I knew of what a contact center should look like, it worked. They were actually achieving some incredible results. They had that every month they were smashing their sales and revenue targets. Their customer experience was off the chart. Culturally, engagement was, you know, next level. And so it then caused me to stop and go, well, why is this the case? How can it be? How can this be the case when there's, you know, there's none of the traditional controls, measures, structures? And what I found was it came back to the organization had such a strong brand and purpose. Mm-hmm. When they recruited, they really recruited the best of the best. And that process that they would put through to screen people, it wasn't just about looking for skills and experience and aptitude. It was heavily focused on cultural fit and alignment to purpose. And then when they brought people in from day one, trust was implicit. You know, everyone had trust from day one until you actually, you know, breached that trust. And that's where the magic was, right? That's where people were just getting on and doing what they were doing. They were making good decisions. You know, the organization was you know, very supportive, and it was a great culture. So there was a real learning for me there around that recruitment process, attracting the right people that believe what you believe and are on board with your purpose, and then also that extension of trust. Now, there were some, you know, sort of, there were some downfalls of that type of culture, and that was, you know, typically people that come in first 6 months, they loved the experience, they were raving to their family and friends, I can't believe this company, it's amazing. But then something interesting happened after about 6 months, you know, that gratitude starts to die off, and then you start to see the culture of entitlement. And so I had to spend a lot of time sort of really connecting, and this is where I first started really focusing on mindfulness and mindset, because I really had to ground people and anchor them back to being grateful and gratitude and appreciating what they have and how fortunate and privileged they are, and not taking away things off them and being punitive, but bringing them on a bit of a journey. So that was sort of my first foray into the power of mindfulness. And then, unfortunately, that industry had a lot of unscrupulous players, and particularly in that vocational education space. So government regulation came in and really squeezed out all the brokers. So I needed to make a change again. And again, I wanted to go into contact centres. I wanted to try something different. And that's where I came to the NRMA. I think the reason why the NRMA appealed for me was I lived on the Central Coast, and the opportunity was leading a contact centre on the Central Coast. And that was really important for me at that time, because I had a young family. I'd been doing the commute into the city an hour and a half every day at my previous role. I wanted to get a better balance, but I wanted to align with an organisation that had that strong purpose, because I understood the power of what it has. And NRMA is an iconic Australian brand, and Mutual is just in such a unique position. You know, we call it our playbook principles, but they really do define and shape behaviors, actions, but even more importantly, decisions. And I think that really came to the test when we responded to COVID and what we did for our people. But yeah, before I talk a bit about that, my first couple of years in NRMA was very consistent with my previous experience of the Optus days. You know, very sort of traditional, conventional contact center with obviously a unique culture of the NRMA overlaid. And things were going along fine. You know, we were happy. We were making incremental ground in customer experience and the agent experience. Engagement was good. And then obviously along came COVID and created significant disruption. Unique to the NRMA or even the contact center industry. But what was really interesting for me was, and I didn't really think about it at the time, but an exec said to me recently that some of the advice they got from a mentor was, you know, disruption can be really challenging, but with disruption, it comes opportunity. And I think that's exactly what defines my journey for the last 3 years, is that COVID was a massive disruption, but it created a unique window of opportunity that perhaps I'd never would have gotten or will never get again had it not been for that pandemic, because it essentially gave, I think, everyone a bit of a license or permission to do things differently because we had to. The burning platform was there. And so for us, our journey was we all got together, like I imagine a lot of organizations did, in a war room and said, okay, this is getting serious now. What are we going to do? And this is where our playbook came in. You know, we first and foremost, our people's safety was the number one priority. And so we made a commitment then. We're going to get everyone to work from home. We didn't have really the infrastructure, the technology, the equipment, no real idea how to do it. In the space of a couple of days, we successfully moved everyone to 100% work from home. And it was a really suboptimal experience. Like I'm talking, you know, we had people having to provide, most people had to provide all their equipment. And we were stitching together different internet connections. Most people were answering, you know, calls from customers through their mobile phone with a, you know, a standard ear pod. And they're doing it for 8 hours a day. And they probably stayed like that for months, to be honest with you. But what we learned in that time was not only that importance of trust again, we had to trust that people would do the right thing. And equally, the trust that they had to have in us, that we would keep them safe and we would make the right decisions and support them along the way. And so that trust really underpinned what we did from there, because even though it was suboptimal, nothing broke. You know, we were, you know, we had a little bit of, as I said, a bit of a license. No one was really, you know, obsessing over some of the traditional metrics, but some of the key objectives of customer experience, service level achievement, employee engagement, probably your revenue and sales performance, all of those things held. In some cases, they actually improved. But we knew it was suboptimal. And so in those first couple of months, I think the difference between perhaps what I understand now between our organization and maybe some others is rather than invest all our time and energy into thinking about the plan of returning people to the office, we went out and spent a lot of time trying to get feedback from our people understanding what was their experience like, how were they feeling, what were their expectations. And I think in that process, which was, you know, surveys, focus groups, one-on-ones, and it wasn't just a once in time, it was sort of a progression of continual check-in and reinforcing what we were hearing, we learned very quickly that people wanted to stay working from home, not just through the COVID pandemic, but ongoing, because their experience and the difference it made and the impact it had on their personal life, you know, was so powerful that they wanted to stay working from home. And I think that's where I'm very fortunate. I work for an organization where I had that support from the executive team to say, you know what, we're going to make this decision to go all in. We're going to look at how do we create and build and sustain a great remote hybrid contact center. And so for the last 3 years, we just spent all our efforts and energy in working towards how we're going to do it. And that's where probably the journey's been quite an interesting one, because in that, what I learned was creating a great remote or hybrid working environment isn't just about providing people with a laptop and an internet connection. It's actually, there's an ecosystem that goes around it. You know, you've got to transform and reinvent so many, or nearly all of your key functions and the parts that make up the contact center. Everything from recruitment to training, to tools and technology, to your operating rhythms and cadences, to communication, to how you innovate, continue to innovate and test and learn. And that's probably been the journey that we have been on. And, you know, we're now at a point where I used to go to contact center conferences, and probably 5 years ago, I'd walk away thinking, you know what, I think we're probably trailing as a contact center in terms of where we are. Now, I think, you know, when I go, I think we're probably leading in a lot of areas, but we were fortunate that we had that disruption and we were able to, you know, sort of pounce on the opportunity that was presented. Mm-hmm. So that's sort of where we are. We've got over 400 people working from home. 100% today are working remotely. And we're seeing really good, really good returns in terms of employee engagement is high. Our customer experience is doing well. We've had all the challenges that everyone else has had in terms of, you know, turnover and attraction of talent. But I think what's happened for us is it's allowed us to think about tapping into new markets and new channels. And that's where we're in a fortunate position where we're thinking different. You know, it's no longer about recruiting people from the traditional Physical locations, we can cast the net now and get a much more dispersed, diverse workforce, and tap into some new capabilities and potential. So that's probably our journey and where I'm at.
What an awesome journey. There's so much in there that I'd love to talk to you about. I've got one question on the point you just covered about your team working remotely. And often team leaders or leaders talk about culture, engagement, and connection as a reason to get people back into the office. They say, well, we need people in the office for a couple of days a week because it's great for culture. So I'm curious, how do you guys tackle that and build culture in a remote environment? What do you think about and how you go about doing that really well?
Yeah, look, that was absolutely something that challenged us in our early days, particularly as we went in and out of lockdowns, where there was an opportunity to come back into a physical office. The first thing we did was there was a mindset shift for the leaders, but we focused on what was the problem? What were we trying to solve? And the problems we were trying to solve were often connection and, isolation and how would we actually get back some of the culture that we had. But what we didn't do was start with the solution. So it was, well, let's unpack the problem and let's understand that our people want to work remotely. So how do we achieve that through a remote setting? And I think it kind of almost just helped us get to a point where we quickly said, trying to build that culture or solve that problem through the office is no longer an option. It's not what our people want. It's not where our future is. So let's focus all our energy and effort on solving that problem in a virtual way. And that's where that sort of ecosystem I spoke about came in. It didn't happen quickly, but we had to look at all the things that we did previously, and there were some really important parts that were key to our DNA. That's what made our culture, particularly in a sales environment, right? It's high energy in an office. They were high-fiving each other, spinning wheels to, claim a prize. It was, ringing a bell if they got a sale. And so that was a big shift. But the adoption of virtual tools is really where we spent a lot of time and just thinking differently. So a good example would be that in our first year, one of the things that we used to do was every year we'd do Christmas raffles right at the end of the year, and we'd give people different prizes. They'd come up and they collect it, and it was a nice way to end the year and go into the festive season. We just went, well, how do we do that in a virtual setting? And so we just came up with it, and it morphed from we could do this and deliver it to we could actually get the manager to go and deliver it. And so as we went into Christmas that year, we had managers going out with legs of ham in their hand, delivering it to someone at the house, getting a photo. It was a bit of a moment. And it started to just, I suppose, Sean, snowball into just starting to think about different ideas. As I said, test and learn, but really it was about reimagining a lot of what we do and doing it through virtual tools. And there are so many untapped opportunities that we've found and benefits through those virtual tools that really do drive strong engagement, and also deliver operational efficiency and make it so much easier. So things like, for example, if you were running a team meeting in an office, often it was a set time. If someone was running late, it was quite disruptive. If someone was sick, you'd have to figure out how you're going to try and catch them up on it. Whereas now you run a virtual meeting, you've got the benefit and flexibility of recording it. If someone misses out, they just watch the video when they get back. If you want to push out a message quickly, in the past, if I wanted to go and brief my whole contact center on something, that'd take me 6 to 8 weeks with workforce planning to schedule it in, book rooms. Now I can do a recording at home and push it out and schedule people in one-on-one to get the message out. And I can still get that two-way dialogue because I use those channels like Teams and chat where people can give me feedback, ask me questions. And I think what we've seen in our culture is that our communication has gotten better since going to remote working because One, I think in part we've been a lot more purposeful. We know how important it is. But two, the access to some of these tools has just meant we're engaging real time in two-way dialogue. It's far more collaborative and it's very transparent in that people can, you know, they've got access to everyone. You know, there's no hierarchy. It's, you know, so there's this really strong engagement. And the other probably key thing that shaped our culture, which was really interesting, was prior to COVID, we had two locations. So essentially, we had two contact centers with different cultures, even though, you know, they came under an overarching. And, you know, often the people never met. They did things slightly differently. Now we are just one contact center with one unique culture, and you know, people talk to everyone. Our rhythms and routines mean that you no longer just have a relationship with your team manager, you have a relationship with every manager because you're dealing with them all day, every day to help support you, coach you. You know, so it's sort of been testing and learning, but focusing on our end goal was we're not going back. Mm-hmm. So how do we just stay on course? And again, I think I've gone to my workforce, I would suggest probably 10 times in the last 2 years to ask the same question to validate our decision-making and our thinking. And overwhelmingly, even though people say they miss connection, when you ask them where they want that connection to take place, they say digitally. So it sort of reinforced that that's just where we need to you know, invest and work.
That's awesome.
It is, isn't it? Sean, I told you this would be a good one. I love it, Scott. And probably the thing that I love the most is, you know, your approach and how you've taken, I think, a first principles mindset. As in, what I mean by that is, like, you know, when you talked about, like, what are we actually trying to solve for? Like, what's the problem that we're trying to solve for? And starting there as opposed to, you know, trying to put a solution in place. Like, we see a lot of contact centers they haven't looked at it like an opportunity with COVID, that a lot of contact centers have sort of gone, how do we get ourselves back to where we were before COVID with some things that we learned, but the goal has just been, how do we get back to where we were before? As opposed to, what does this now mean for us? How do we reimagine everything? Now, my question to you, Scott, is, you know, are there, and thinking about the people that are listening to this, right? You've got leaders and such that are listening to this pod now. What are your... like, how do you have that mindset? Because it feels like that's what you've done throughout probably a lot of your career. You've gone with an open mind to kind of rethink, well, how can you do things better? Like, what are some things that you do to do that? Or is there a philosophy or a mindset that you have? Like, what's the magic in that?
Yeah, look, I think, and it sounds a bit cliched in that, you know, it's really trying to deliver results through people. So if you start with, you know, the people you're hiring, and you know, they're the ones that are actually going to deliver your outcomes, what do they need to be successful, you know, and what type of person is successful in your environment and that cultural fit that I talked about before. So it's probably just a people first approach in terms of philosophy, but in terms of organizationally and how that transfers into results and, you know, getting the support of the organization, I think my learning has been often contact centers are very misunderstood. You know, everyone says, oh, they're the heartbeat of the organization. But really, you know, if you step outside the contact center, people have very little understanding or appreciation for the day-to-day. And so I think as a leader, it's about how do you bring the rest of your organization on the journey through education? And it is doing a lot of showcases and stand-ups and being quite, I suppose, you've got to be brave to be able to also talk about where things aren't working and the mistakes you've made along the way, what you learned and why you want to do it so that people understand it. And, you know, we've got, I mentioned our playbook before, one of ours is, you know, we'll walk in your shoes. And that is really about getting people to walk in the shoes of our frontline and our customers so they really understand it when they're thinking about product design or process design or any type of change they want to lead. So it really is about bringing people outside the contact center on the journey through education and really getting them in. Sometimes, you know, it's been a case of, maybe just, you know, letting things fall over, you know, and being open to let things fail, so it exposes the gap and the priority of why you need to invest. Because sometimes it's really hard to get things done. And I think the opportunity out of COVID was you bypassed all the formal governance processes and business casing. You just got on with it. Whereas now you're back into that routine. So how do you approach it? And my advice would be just start small. As I said, for 12 months, our people worked from home in a suboptimal way. You know, but in that 12 months, we spent the time looking at how we're going to fix it. So now everyone has a standardized, you know, desktop setup, monitors, a proper headset. We provide the internet connection. It's all nice and secure, so the data governance people are happy. And then we just built, worked on that ecosystem one by one. How do you then start to redesign your recruitment process to be virtual? You know, and I think we're up to probably our 20th incarnation of what that looks like, because each time, probably the one discipline we did have was retros. Every time we did it, we'd get everyone back, what worked, what didn't, what do we want to do next time? And it was really incremental. And now we're at a point where it's still not where we want it to be from a training point of view. The online experience is certainly a lot better, but we know where we want to go. We've got a really clear ambition, which is I want to be able to recruit anywhere, anytime, and train and onboard people. Move away from this, like what a lot of contact centers do, recruit 10 people at once. Recruit them on these set days. Ask them to work these set hours because that's what works for your organization, not for them. As opposed to saying, if I can do anywhere, anytime, then, you know, people, I overcome that problem, and I really extend the true definition of flexibility for people, which isn't just anymore about location. It's about time. And so that's really where, that's, you know, the next year or 2 years, however long it takes us, that's our end goal. But what we know is that's really exciting because we don't have all this work and effort that goes into bulk recruitment and training. And particularly in the last couple of years, where, you know, it's just been nonstop. I think that's probably the approach or methodology we take to it.
There's, I think that, as we round this out, it'd be great for you to just give a couple of things for leaders that are listening to say that, look, I love all those things that you're doing with your team. I'd love to have that level of flexibility. But how would I start? Like if I'm a leader that's a little bit afraid of letting go of some of that control, I love the structure because it gives me the control. I want to see people face to face in person because I feel like that giving me a sense of safety. Where would you recommend that a leader who's maybe thinking like that, but is open to embracing that different mindset, the mindset that you've talked to us about, where would they start?
I think you start small. So I think, well, first of all, you need to understand, is that actually what your people and your workforce want? You know, what is it that they actually want? Yeah, because some want hybrid arrangement. And I should mention that we never said you can't go back to an office. We've the whole way through, we said you can go into an office whenever you want, but it's on your choice and control, your terms, not ours. We're not going to make you come in for 3 days to do something you want to do at home. But we are working on a plan around how we create purposeful face-to-face connection. But I think starting small, I think, you know, choose a team and look at setting them up. I think you've got to be really open to it's we call it progress, not perfection. You've got to be open to the fact that it's probably going to be suboptimal. If it's the first time I dip in the toe in the water of remote working, things will go wrong. But be open to that's okay. Also, I think you've got to be really open to the fact that you can't apply all the things you do today and think that that's going to work in a remote hybrid setting. Yeah, If you're worried about people's performance, the reality is contact centers are the most heavily monitored, measured, individuals in any organization. You'll still have all of that. So you don't have to worry about that. That's all still going to be there. You'll know whether someone's logged in and whatever. I think it's, again, it's about having that trust. Do you trust your people? Do you trust they're going to do the right thing? And I think you'll find if it's what they want, they'll reciprocate that trust by doing the right thing and they won't let you down. And through that process, it is constant engagement with those people. What's working? What's not working? You know, what are their challenges? And that will start to feed into the plan of how you would build a sustainable work from home or hybrid model, because it'll tell you where to start. Maybe the first thing you need that's most important for your organization is they need knowledge management, because they can no longer ask the person next to them. And you don't have good documented processes or an engine or a repository to surface it. Or it could be something completely different. So I think start small. Don't be afraid to test and learn. I think you'll be pleasantly surprised that nothing falls over. Mm. And if anything, the opportunities that surface will kind of blow your mind.
Yeah, it does strike me. You've really embraced disruption, and not just the disruption of COVID, but then the other disruptions that, you know, that staff don't want to or would prefer to work from home, and embracing that as well and seeing that as an opportunity. And also that you've sort of taken your own ego out of this, and as a leader, lots of leaders say, well, how do I design this system around me and my preferences? And you've sort of removed that and said, well, how do we actually design this system around what the organization and our customers need, and what would enable our people to do that in the most effective way? And that's what I love most about this. And trust, I think, sits underneath all of that. So that's beautiful. I mean, you're ticking off every agile principle that exists here with the way that it works.
Yes. So, yeah, it's so good.
I need to disclose, I've never done any agile accreditation. Yeah. Obviously, I've led change to agile projects initiatives, but it was really just that sort of incremental approach, I think, to test learn.
And I think if people could take that away, that's a great point, because I've always thought the principles that sit behind agile are just innately human. They just seem like they seem like they're natural, and I mean natural by nature. It's just how things ought to be. And you've just followed what has felt, I suppose, natural for you, and just so happens that aligns to a lot of the principles for agile as well. So
I think it's courage.
Well,
I think too, Sean.
Yeah. Well, I think one of the things that I think people need to be open to is that the traditional controls that contact centers typically have in place tend to go out the window a bit, in that contact centers historically have always tried to be really uniform. And what you learn through this opportunity is you have to challenge your conventional or traditional ways of doing things. And one really good example I could share with you is when we first went to work from home, we had an element, like we encourage people to, you know, when they come on a call or in a meeting, you know, go on camera, because we want to see people, you know, see body language, you know, that was really important. But we didn't force it, because people, you know, at different stages need to get comfortable, and we needed to teach them and lead them through experience rather than through direction. The value of what they get out of it when they do it, you know, sort of move away from precedence and, you know, conformity, and just focus on the individual.
Yeah. Yeah, that's awesome. I think you're right, Arnie. It is a lot of courage. It's courage to trust yourself to lead in that way, to not have to have everything fit a cookie cutter and one size fits all for everyone. That does take a lot of courage. So very inspiring, Scott. Thank you so much for sharing your story. I'd love to get you back for part two, because there's a lot of stuff around the structures that you spoke about and how to set up trust-based structures in contact centers. And I think you'd probably add a lot of value in talking to our audience about that stuff as well. So if you're keen for that, we'll set up another session and get you back.
Yeah, absolutely. We'd love to.
Beautiful. All right. Hey, we're almost on time. So any last thoughts from you, Scott? Where do you think things are headed in the contact center world over the next 5 years?
Well, look, probably the key prediction, so to speak, that I think is that I actually think the contact center won't be a center at all. I think that, you know, those that haven't invested in providing remote working or hybrid flexible arrangements are going to be left behind. I think it's here to stay. And so I think that, you know, contact channels will be, you know, a distributed network of agents and technologies that will be able to deliver service from anywhere at any time through any channel based on the customer needs. And I think that fundamentally will drive a big shift in the way people think about a contact center, and, you know, the different channels and the service models and everything that sits below that. So I think that's probably my biggest sort of prediction around where I think in the next 5 years you'll see that sort of that shift.
Beautiful, beautiful. All right, let's wrap things
Amazing.
Up. Thank you so much for listening, everyone. Please follow us on your favorite streaming service. Follow us on LinkedIn. Go and start following Scott on LinkedIn. Follow Arnie there as well. But thanks so much for your generosity and sharing your story today, Scott. Have loved hearing that. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Scott. Woo!
No, thanks for having me.
All right.
Thanks, Arnie.
Thanks, everyone. Bye.
Bye for now.